You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The holy month of Ramadan began yesterday, and Iraq is preparing for a U.S.-led attack. Countries around the world are preparing for a certain economic fallout. In India, trade with Iraq came to over $1 billion this year. Not only the Iraqi community in India is concerned about the potential war on Iraq, politicians and the media are also raising serious questions. From Delhi, the capital of India, Miranda Kennedy reports.
This is the Iraqi school in Delhi. There are over 100 students here, crowded into classrooms in former kitchens and storage rooms. The wall of every classroom features a framed portrait of Saddam Hussein. All the teachers are Iraqi, and the classes are in Arabic. Many of these students will go on to study in India's universities. Before the UN imposed sanctions on Iraq, this school was free, like all schools and universities in Iraq. But since the 90s, things have only gotten worse, says Rajria Ismahid, who teaches English at the school.
Before, this school was containing most of the Arabs, and they were coming here for free education, and they don't have to pay anything, even their books, whatever they need. It means even there was school bus to take all the children to their houses. But now it is very clear that it means the sanction is affecting us too much now. And now America again is trying to hit Iraq. So it is very clear now. It means the sanction is affecting us very badly.
India does more trade with Iraq than any European country. This year, trade between India and Iraq came to over $1 billion. For India, that means oil. This July, India's state oil company signed a $600 million deal to drill for oil in southern Iraq. Salah al-Mukhtar, the ambassador of Iraq to India, expects that Indo-Iraq trade will double in the next year, unless there is a war. And that's the main reason, he says, that India's government is against the proposed war on Iraq.
India will be among the number one victims of any war will be waged on Iraq. India has the reserve of oil of 15 days. After 15 days, India will face a very critical economic situation. The oil prices will jump to maybe $100 per barrel. India has 4 million Indians working in the Gulf. The Gulf will be the battlefield of the war. There is no way to distinguish between Indians and Arabs there.
But although all Indian party leaders, including leaders of the ruling BJP party, have told al-Mukhtar that they stand firmly against the war on Iraq, the official Indian government response has been muted. The Indian government has halted direct flights between Delhi and Baghdad, seriously dampening trade between the countries. The Indian Ministry of Foreign Affairs told Peace Watch it could not comment on Iraq. But while the Indian government has not spoken out publicly against the war, India's media is increasingly critical about the economic and political effects of such a war. Jug Saraya is a longtime editor and columnist at The Times of India. When the U.S. attacked Afghanistan last October, Saraya started a daily comic strip called W-Man, featuring its namesake, President George W. Bush, and Indian Prime Minister Atal Vajpayee.
I first thought of W-Man as a kind of a Superman-type hero, which would signify the military might and muscle of America. But unfortunately, he has the brain of a George W. Bush. So this makes him sort of doubly dangerous.
Saraya's comic strip has become a popular mouthpiece for his political views on Indian and U.S. foreign policy. He was overwhelmed with fan mail when he published this comic strip after the bomb blast in Bali, Indonesia.
So in the first frame, we have W-Man saying, "The terrorists went that away," and there's a signboard which says, "Iraq." And then in the next frame, you have Vajpayee saying, "No, no, they went that way," and you have a signboard saying Pakistan. And in the last frame, you have one of the bomb blast victims looking very charred around the edges, and there's sort of rubble and debris all around him. And the bomb blast victim is thinking, "All I know is that the roof went that way," and he's pointing one finger towards the sky. So political leaders will see terrorism in whichever direction they want to. It's the innocent bystanders who get caught in the crossfire, and they're the ones who suffer, who get wounded, who die.
Saraya believes that the Indian government will not roundly condemn the war on Iraq simply because their investment in the U.S. is greater than their investment in Iraq. Like many, he believes India sees cooperating with the U.S.-led war on terror as the key to solving their problems with Pakistan.
The political class in India seems to feel that if it wins brownie points with Washington, Washington will somehow side with India in favor, against Pakistan, which I think is an extremely puerile and jejune way of looking at international relations, because India and Pakistan have got to learn to live together.
But Salah al-Mukhtar believes there's a more compelling reason for India to stand by Iraq, its own long-term plans for advancement. Iraq's potential is not limited to its massive oil reserves. Despite the economic sanctions, Iraq is a technologically advanced nation, which India can look to in its struggle for development.
India is fully aware about the potentials of Iraq. That's why it is not ready to sacrifice a friend in the hand for the purpose of guaranteeing a party surrounded by huge suspicion, which is the United States. Yes, they want strategic cooperation with the United States. They want an equal partnership. America wants to exploit India against China and against other nations. America wants to exploit the markets of India, but not to help India to become a new superpower. India is dreaming of becoming a new superpower.
Us Salah is a political science student at Delhi's Jawaharlal Nehru University. He says that the Bush administration's threats of war have strengthened nationalist feeling in Iraq. In fact, he thinks President Saddam Hussein can thank the Bush administration for his recent unanimous re-election.
If not President Bush has made these threats and increased his language against Iraq, maybe the elections would have been not 100%. But the Iraqis, they believe that Saddam Hussein is protecting them from the Americans that are trying to occupy Iraq. So President Saddam Hussein for them is like a leader that wants to make Iraq a secular nation and make it free from the American control, because the Americans are controlling all the Arab countries, Arab states that produce oil in the Gulf.
Salah hopes that India will help to avert another war in Iraq, but he promises that if there is a war, he will abandon his studies here and return to Iraq to fight. And if there is a war in Iraq, the principal of the Iraqi school here in Delhi says they will have to close their doors so the teachers can also return to Iraq to take up arms. In Delhi, India, I'm Miranda Kennedy for Pacifica Peace Watch.
In his speech announcing the UN resolution this morning, President Bush repeated his claim that military action against Iraq was necessary because Saddam Hussein poses a threat to the United Nations, or rather to the United States, the Middle East region, and the people of this country. I spoke earlier with Edmund Garib, professor of Kurdish studies at American University, and asked him about the truth behind these claims.
There's no doubt that the Iraqi regime is a repressive regime. It's a dictatorial regime. It's a regime which has, oppressed its own people in the sense that it has stifled dissent and made it difficult for opponents of the regime to express their views. But on the other hand, there's also many things that where the regime has also played an important role during certain periods, especially when after the 1975 period, the regime spent a great deal of money to rebuild the country's infrastructure, to eradicate illiteracy, to help give women a greater role in the society, and to open up opportunities in front of them. So while there are some very negative things, there have been historically some positive things.
Saddam Hussein's regime helped with the illiteracy and women's rights?
The Ba'ath regime, yes.
The Ba'ath regime.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so he is, of course, at the head of the Ba'ath regime. What would happen if he were removed from that equation?
Well, I think, this is the big question now. I mean, Iraq has, since that time, since he came to power in 1979 and the Ba'ath came to power in 68, but since that time, there have been so many changes that taking place inside Iraq, where Iraq has gone through two devastating wars. First, the Iran-Iraq War, which cost Iraq hundreds of thousands of casualties. There was a great deal of destruction of its infrastructure. There was also a great impoverishment of the country. Then we saw after that the invasion of Kuwait and the second Gulf War, where there was even far more devastation of Iraq's infrastructure, and the situation deteriorated rapidly in the country. This was a country where you had a thriving middle class and one of the best educational and public health systems in the region before the war. Now these fell apart. The struggle for survival became the sole driving force in the country. People became more dependent on the regime because of the sanctions, which had a devastating impact. And so people could not even challenge the regime had they wished to do so. The civil society collapsed. The sanctions made the population dependent on the regime for survival. One of the things that's, also very interesting is that the country itself has also been under attack, not only because of the sanctions, but there have been also attacks almost sometimes on a daily, sometimes on a weekly basis. And there has been also two no-fly zones over the northern part and southern part of the country, which were not approved by the United Nations. And so this has been extremely negative, had negative consequences for the people of Iraq. And we all know the reports that came from UNESCO, that came from the World Health Organization, and from the International Red Cross about the impact of all of these events, mm-hmm. especially the sanctions.
But so now, if Saddam Hussein were removed from that Ba'ath Party, is it your opinion that the party would be able to select another leader that might serve the Iraqi people better?
I think this is, right now it's very difficult to say what would happen, because the Ba'ath Party, first of all, there have been also very significant changes that have taken place when it comes to the character of the party. One of the things that Saddam Hussein did is that he greatly expanded the party. The party historically was a small party that was limited to small numbers of people when it seized power twice, by the way, in Iraq, once in 1963, and then it was ousted a few months later. And then the second time was in 1968. But Saddam Hussein expanded the party, and that brought in a lot of people who may not have been true believers, but people who saw this as a way to get a head or to get a position in the government. And so that there are questions as to how effective the party is and how relevant it still is to Iraqi society.
Edmund Garib, professor of Kurdish studies at American University. As we inch closer to war with Iraq, we need to further examine the impacts on the people of Iraq. One group that is often mentioned is the Kurds in Iraq. Washington has promised to protect Kurdish-held northern Iraq from an attack from Saddam Hussein during any military action to topple him. Sonali Kolhatar from Pacifica Station KPFK in L.A. interviewed Connie Hulam, the director of the American Kurdish Information Network, a group that aims to foster Kurdish-American friendship and understanding. Connie analyzed the prospects for Kurds as well as the policies of Turkey with respect to Kurds. He discusses the rights to self-determination of Kurds and the cynical view of how Kurds have experienced freedom for the last 11 years.
You know, it wasn't just in 1991 that the United States urged the Kurds to fight the central government in Baghdad and left them high and dry. It was also in 1975, during Nixon administration, when Henry Kissinger met with the senior Barzani, the father of the present Kurdish leader in northern Iraq, Masoud Barzani, in Tehran, and promised him help if he fights central government. So we've been through this road before, and I'm personally filled with trepidation that the United States government will use the Kurds again to topple the government in Baghdad, to bring in somebody who is pliable, who gives in to U.S. demands, and keep the status quo, which we believe is created in 1923 after the First World War, which basically dismembered the state of Kurdistan or the province of Kurdistan at the time, and gave portions of it to Iraq, portions of it to Syria, portions of it to Turkey, portions of it to Iran.
Now, the two major groups in Iraq that are presenting their largest armed opposition to Saddam Hussein are the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan and the Kurdistan Democratic Party. Just recently, Jalal Talabani, the leader of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, said that, I'll read a quote, he said, "The Iraqi opposition has asked the United States to acknowledge the effective parties on the Iraqi scenes are the ones who must undertake changing and replacing the regime along with the United States."
I guess I could answer you both from the Kurdish perspective as well as the perspective of the opposition to the government in Baghdad, which includes also the Sunnis as well as the Shiites. The Arab majority and the Kurdish minority in terms of ethnic backgrounds, and then in terms of religious backgrounds, the Sunnis and the Shiites. Not much is being said, or whatever is being said is said in tongue-in-cheek, if you will, in terms of the Kurdish contribution or the Kurdish, what will happen afterwards in terms of the plight of the Kurds or the welfare of the Kurds. Kurds constitute one-fifth of the country. They sit on one-third of the oil, and they have been fighting for basically most basic human rights since the inception of the Iraqi state, which was created by the British government. And in terms of the opposition, I mean, what goes on here in Washington is, you know, once Saddam goes, everything is going to be dandy. Everything is going to just, all the human rights violations are going to disappear. Unfortunately, that's not really what's happening on the ground. There's a culture of intolerance towards the minorities. There's a culture of violence in Iraq. And, you know, with the going of one person, that's not going to disappear. If the United States government wants stability in the region, it needs to recognize the elements that constitute Iraq, get into the details in terms of the Kurds, the Shiites, and the Sunnis, and validate them and recognize them as such. That's not what I hear. That's not what I see happening. Talabani and Barzani, the two leaders, for now are acknowledging or are saying that we want federal solution. We want basically a federal model the way we have federal state and federal model here in the United States, like California is nominally independent, but yet it's part of the federal government. I mean, Turkey is opposed to that, for example, and U.S. is obliged to Turkey because it's going to use Turkish bases.
You know, we hear a lot about the Halabja massacre, for example, in 1988, and we hear a lot about how Saddam Hussein has very seriously oppressed the Kurds, which is absolutely true. He has been incredibly brutal to the Kurdish population, as has the Turkish regime.
Mm-hmm.
As a Kurd yourself, Kani, how do you look at the upholding of the Kurds by the U.S. as a reason to go to war? And do you think that this sort of rhetoric of liberation, are you comfortable with this?
I'm very uncomfortable with it. You know, Halabja happened in 1988. The Reagan administration did not even acknowledge it. You know, mm-hmm. It was a crime against humanity. Forget about the Kurds. A civilian population was subjected to chemical and biological weapons. This is basically the second time use against them. The first time during the First World War, the civilian, German and then the French armed forces were using it against each other. But the civilian population was, for the first time, in 1988, March 16, where 5,000 Kurds dropped dead in a matter of seconds. To this day, I mean, there are repercussions that the World Health Organization has not even tackled. For example, a British geneticist has gone and done research from University of Liverpool, and she talks about, literally a time bomb, where she talks about the alteration in the genetics of the people that had inhaled these fumes and now give birth to monsters, I mean, to people without legs or to people without limbs, to people with three eyes, if you will. I mean, all kinds of genetic malformations have taken place. When this has happened to us and nobody is noticing us or nobody is trying to even help us, and now that the U.S. has been hurt, and it's unfortunate that it has been hurt, it was hurt on September 11th, all of a sudden our dead are dusted up, if you will, and are branded as reason for this war, and it is absolutely diabolical. It's just wrong. It's blasphemous to do that, and I resent it very much. We are the most dispensable, the most expendable, the most vulnerable elements in the Middle East in terms of the countries that occupy us. When something happens in Iraq, the Kurds suffer the most. the history has proven us right too, 75, 91, 88, and now this coming war. In terms of the aspirations, yeah, make no mistake about it. We want kind of like East Timor, where hopefully like a referendum where our will is consulted, and what we want is you know, registered. And the abuse we have been subjected to is, I mean, it's indescribable, if you will. And as a result, we want separation. Yeah, we have been abused. I mean, if we were treated right, we might not have asked for separate states. But we have been abused, and as a result, we do ask for separate states. But the reality is we are outgunned, we are outnumbered, our adversaries are way stronger than us. And as a result, the Kurdish leadership in Iraq, for example, wants a federal model, a federal solution where at least they have local autonomy. They have their own tax collectors. They have their own Kurdish teachers. They have their own Kurdish police officers.
And right the now, language.
Yeah, and then they want to preserve their language. I mean, 5,000, 6,000 years old heritage, they want to be able to give it to their children.
Can you talk a little bit about your position in general on the U.S. designs on Iraq, just in general, not specifically to the Kurds?
You know, 9/11 did raise serious questions in terms of the U.S. foreign policy towards the region as well as the world. There are people here who talk about, you know, we cannot afford to cuddle dictators or semi-dictators or people who do not give equal benefits of law and liberty to their populations. And that's healthy, but it needs more needs to be done. I mean, I personally believe the policy that this country should pursue towards the Middle East is one of, it should be one of understanding the Middle East with all its diversity, with all its richness, as opposed to knowing these dictators and cuddling them and arming them with Pentagon toys and then hoping that things will work out for the good.
Connie Hulam of the American Kurdish Information Network, interviewed by Sonali Kolhatar from Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. Noted author and MIT professor Noam Chomsky spoke recently at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He faced some audience questions on the logic of using force to secure U.S. interest in the Middle East and when it is appropriate to use force in the face of a nuclear threat.
Hi, my name is David Goldstein. I'm in the MPAID program here at Kennedy School. My views tend to fall on the center-left in the spectrum of things, but for the sake of discussion, you made an interesting point in your talk, which is that the real reason we're going into Iraq, or the administration wants to go to Iraq, is to get the oil.
Yeah.
So if you accept that to be true, which I do, isn't there a certain calculus that someone who's sitting in the shoes of a Condoleezza Rice could make, that they're responsible for the best outcome for American citizens, and there's an upside of going into Iraq, which is we get this greatest material possession, one of the greatest material possessions in the world history, and there are downsides, which are we upset the international community, and maybe there's more terrorism, and couldn't you envision a calculus where they say, sure, that's the reason, and it's a good reason, let's do it. What's the flaw in the calculus?
Oh, I think that's exactly their calculus, but then we ought to just be honest and say, look, we're a bunch of Nazis. So fine, let's just drop all the discussion. You know, we save a lot of trees, and we can throw out the newspapers and most of the scholarly literature, and just come out state and straight and tell the truth. You know, say we'll do whatever we want because we think we're going to gain by it. And incidentally, it's not American citizens will gain. They don't gain by this. It's narrow sectors of power, domestic power, that the administration is serving with quite unusual dedication. Yeah, they'll gain. So, you know, Dick Cheney will gain, Halliburton will gain, so on and so forth. American high-tech industry will gain. So, for example, one of the ways of recycling petrodollars is selling arms. Now, that's misleadingly called the military-industrial complex, but anybody who looks carefully, certainly anybody who works at MIT, where it pays our salaries, knows perfectly well that the military system is kind of a cover for high-tech industry. I mean, anyone who's using a computer or telecommunications or the internet or, you know, gets benefits from automation or containerization or you just name it. I mean, it's all, a lot of it's coming out of the state sector of the economy, which is very dynamic and innovative. It operates under the cover of military spending quite often. So there's kind of gains that sort of dribble down. But if that's what we're interested in, fine, let's just say it instead of all the lying.
I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair and ask the last question. What if you believed that Saddam Hussein had biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons and was imminently going to use them, perhaps not on us, but on his neighbors, would there be any circumstances that you would agree that it would be worthwhile for the U.S. to use military force against him?
Well, as I said, there's better options. For example, letting Iran use military force, which has enormous advantages over letting U.S. use military force, for example, those I mentioned, except for the flaw. It doesn't leave us in control and it doesn't handle the political problems. But there certainly are cases where it might be possible. But let me repeat, nobody in the region is worried about it. Isn't that a little surprising? I mean, Kuwait and Iran, for example, both of them invaded by Saddam when he was our ally. They're not calling for the use of military force. In fact, they're opposing it. The only country in the region that's calling for military force is Israel, and they have their own reasons. I mean, I'm strongly opposed to allowing Iraq to develop nuclear weapons. That's why when George Bush and number one and his cohorts were providing assistance to Saddam in developing nuclear weapons, I was writing against it and opposing it. I'll give you the citations if you want. That's 1990, 1998, 1989, 1988. Yeah, I was strongly opposing the U.S. and British efforts at the time to provide Saddam with the means of developing weapons of mass destruction. I think it was horrifying. And I certainly wouldn't want it to happen now. And if we're interested in stopping it, yeah, everybody knows the way. You get inspectors back. It's certainly for nuclear weapons that's going to work, maybe not for everything else. But just think for a second. Suppose I had nuclear weapons in my backyard, for instance. Would it be a threat to anyone? Or would it be a deterrent? Well, only under one condition, that I let people know I had them. Okay? If they're hidden in my garage, then neither a threat nor a deterrent. Right? Everybody knows this. If Saddam Hussein, in the extremely unlikely contingency that he'll develop nuclear weapons, if they were to be usable for anything, he'd have to let people know he had them. Well, the minute there's a hint that he has them, Iraq gets obliterated. Okay. Suppose there was any move made towards using them. Well, you know, they get obliterated squared. You know. That's why the people in the region, apart from not believing it, aren't afraid of it, and why they're afraid of the United States.
Noam Chomsky, speaking at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Thanks to Martin Volker of No U-Turn Radio for that segment. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our engineer today was Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett of KPFA and David Russo of the D.C. Indy Media Center. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting their website at pacificaarchives.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.